Hi, and welcome to this edition of Catholic Answers Focus. My name is Patrick Coffin. In the second part of today's edition of the podcast, we're going to talk to actor Kevin Costner. Costner's best known for his roles in Field of Dreams, JFK, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, The Untouchables. He's made almost 50 films, and he has a new film on racism and custody. It's called Black or White. I've seen the film, and I can tell you the best parts of the movie didn't make it into the trailer. It's a very interesting, very emotional human story of a grandfather who's a little bit boozy and crabby, and he ends up going toe-to-toe with the paternal grandmother of his biracial granddaughter, Eloise. We're going to talk to Kevin Costner shortly about the film and about the backdrop of racism in this country. But first, racism as a sin. Many Catholics don't know that racism is a sin. It's been defined that way by the U.S. bishops and in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Joining us to talk about racism that lingers, and it's part of the ongoing narrative of American history, unfortunately. We'll get to the roots of racism, which is, of course, sin. Our good friend Deacon Harold Burke Sivers is here to talk about this. He's appeared in Envoy magazine, Catholic World Report. He has degrees from Notre Dame and the University of Dallas. He's an ordained deacon with the Diocese of Portland, Oregon. He's a multiple TV host and author with EWTN. We welcome back Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Hey, Deacon.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Patrick, and my first time being on the Catholic Answers Focus, so I'm very excited. Thank you.
We are, too. We just started on January 2nd, and we've got a really eclectic lineup of guests, and we've got tons and tons of very positive feedback, so we're excited. We're glad you could carve out some time for us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much for thinking about me.
Both websites will get you to Deacon Harold if you want to invite him to your next event, by the way, deaconharold.com or dynamicdeacon.com. See, Deacon, can I pay you later, or do you want to do a credit card swipe now? Okay. The Catechism of the Catholic Church mentions in number 1934, maybe we can start there, the section of the Catechism is called Equality and Differences Among Men, and it says, created in the image of the one God and equally endowed with rational souls, all men have the same nature and same origin. Redeemed by the sacrifice of Christ, all are called to participate in the same divine beatitude. All, therefore, enjoy an equal dignity. The equality of men rests, this is 1935 now, the equality of men rests essentially on their dignity as persons and the rights that flow from it. Every form of social or cultural discrimination in fundamental personal rights on the grounds of sex, race, color, social conditions, language, or religion must be curbed and eradicated as incompatible with God's design. Deacon Harold, as an African-American person, as a leader in the church and an ordained deacon, do you find that racism continues to be a major problem in the country, or is it just kind of gone underground and given a different form?
Well, I think it's still a major problem in the country, sadly. There's been a number of incidents around the country that I think reflect this attitude, regardless of what you think about the particular incidents themselves. Mm-hmm. Race has always seems to play a role in the discussion with regard to, particularly to the police actions in African-American communities. But when we look at the roots of this, I think the Catechism nails it on the head. You have to go back and look from the beginning. God made all of us in his image and likeness. And the words that are used there are very important. The word image is tselem in Hebrew. It literally means a shadow that is the outline or representation of the original. So the outline or representation of the original. So if you think about your shadow for a second, it is the outline of you, but it's not you. But yet when you move, the shadow moves. And so when you look at what this means in spiritually, God, in a sense, imprints the shadow, his shadow, onto our souls so that obviously we're not God, but we are in the image of God, so that when we think, God thinks. When we speak, God speaks. When we love, God loves. That was his plan from the beginning. And then we're also in his likeness, which is demuth in Hebrew, which means similar. So, for example, if I'm standing and to my left is a statue of me and to my right is my son, we may say that the The statue is more, looks more like me. It's more my likeness, but my son has my essence, my being, my nature within him. Mm-hmm. He has my stuff. In Greek, my ousia is within my son. Mm-hmm. So even though the statue is more in my, looks more like me, my son actually is more in my likeness. And that's the key. If we understand who we are in God and how God looks at us and how we are to look at each other in this image and likeness, everything would be fine. But we know that Genesis 3, Satan comes in and his whole point is to destroy covenant relationship with God. And notice the first thing that Adam and Eve noticed after the fall. They knew they were naked. The last line of Genesis 2 says they were naked and not ashamed because they were looking at each other through God's eyes. They were seeing in each other what God sees. After sin comes into the world, the first thing they recognize is that they were naked. They no longer see each other through God's eyes. They see each other as objects. And that is the problem today when we talk about racism. We no longer see God's image and likeness in the other person. We look at the other person and we immediately make a judgment about that person solely based on how they look. Mm-hmm. And we know that this is learned behavior. I mean, Patrick, you have kids. I have kids, right?
Yep.
When the kids were small, I remember taking my kids to preschool and kindergarten. Man, these kids would just play together. I mean, they don't care what color, what race, nothing, whether you're poor or rich. Mm-hmm. Kids just get together and they play and have fun. They just see the kid in each other. And that's part of the reason why I think Jesus says, unless we're like children, we can't enter the kingdom of heaven. He's not talking about acting childish or childlike.
Yeah.
But it has that beautiful childlike innocence when we look at each other and just accept each other in the way that God made us.
And Deacon, I like the little finesse there. I think it's Matthew's gospel. It says little children. So not 8-year-olds, more like 2 or 3-year-olds, right? Little children. That's the most colorblind zone of all, it seems to me.
Yeah, because back to we're talking about learned behavior. We're mm-hmm. talking about racism. When you look at little children, they're oblivious to the fact that one's a different color or another. They're just kids. Mm-hmm. But as we get older, as we become influenced by certain elements, sadly, because we're still feeling the effects of original sin in the world, we're still dealing with those effects. So kids learn that the way you perceive someone, there's certain stereotypes that go along with that. For example, today, Patrick, when I walk into an elevator and there's, say, a Caucasian woman there, and just me and her, and I see this. I mean, she'll move a little closer to the back and, like, clutch her purse a little tighter.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that going on. I'm like, I just kind of say, well, that's a shame. It really is a shame that she can't just look at me and just deal with me as me. She sees mm-hmm. a stereotype. And, there's television, there's all kinds of things that perpetuate these stereotypes.
Yeah.
But what we need to do is to learn to look past that and to get back to that original understanding of how God sees us and how we need to see each other.
The ones who control the cultural conversation, the elite media, make money off of conflict and the perception of conflict, whether it's real or imagined. I'm thinking of the language battles, Deacon Harold. For the last 50 years, people of black extraction or heritage have had different preferences of nomenclature. So you go from Negro, colored, African-American. Actor Benedict Cumberbatch, the actor who was in Sherlock, very, very talented actor, he made an offhand remark. He certainly didn't intend it, but he used the phrase colored people or colored actor. I forget the exact phrase. Well, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, took umbrage and he had to apologize more than once. So there's an irony there, given the name of the NAACP, obviously. He's simply using the nomenclature that they use. So people are afraid to even talk about race. It's the biggest, brightest, or one of them anyway, third rails in our society. How much of this is driven by the media's desire to increase the conflict and throw gas on the fire?
Well, I think you bring up an important point, Patrick. The thing is that controversy sells. It makes news. It gets ratings. And I think, sadly, that does play into it. I mean, the incident you just referenced, I'm sure that that actor did not intend to use the phrase, to discriminate. I mean, out of, racism. He said it innocently. And so what we do then, instead of looking at the intent, we just take what the person says on face value, even though it may be an innocent thing, and make a big deal of it. Because, see, look, racism still exists in the country. And I think, sadly, we sometimes perpetuate that. We need to look at what the intent is of what the person... For example, someone said to me, referred to me as black, and then they said, African-American. I'm like, right. Look, first of all, I wasn't born in the United States, so I'm a naturalized citizen. I do consider myself American, but, I wasn't born in the United States, so you don't have to use African-American for me.
Where were you born?
And also, in my parish, we have a ton of people from Africa who do not like being called African-Americans. They said, I'm not American, I'm African.
Right. No, Deacon, I know a white guy from Pretoria, and he would tick off African-Canadian. Right? He was whiter than I was, but he was born in Africa, and he was proud of his African heritage. But I didn't know that about you. Where were you born?
Barbados.
You were? Okay, right on. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't identify with that African-American tribal tag so much.
No, I mean, black African-American. Yeah. I mean, like, this way, black Catholics, African-American. I mean, look, to me, the thing is the intent. Are you maliciously trying to demean a person by the language that you're using?
Right.
Or are you just using the language that you hear and the culture and just to express an idea, an opinion, or maybe describe someone?
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, we need to be aware of the language that we're using, but sometimes if someone innocently says something and they don't mean anything by it, you know, then maybe we say, hey, you know, that word means this today, or you may not understand, instead of making a big deal about it and really get to what the person's intent is. Again, it all comes back to me, Patrick, this idea about judging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't judge me. Look, here's a Catholic principle. We love everyone, but we don't love their actions, and we judge actions. We never judge people.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can get that right, we can make some serious headway putting a big dent in racism in this country.
One man you and I both admire, you know a lot more about him than I do, was born in 1854, the son of slaves. Think of it, 1854. That was the year that the Immaculate Conception was defined. This is not that long ago historically. This is pre-Dred Scott decision, so people had other human beings as property. Augustine, sometimes called Augustus Tolton, born in 1854, was eventually, after probably an unbelievable uphill battle, was ordained to the Catholic priesthood in 1886. No seminary in the U.S. would touch him. He eventually got ordained in Rome, I believe the Church of St. John Lateran, where he was expected to go to Africa. He's now servant of God. Tell me how you first learned about Father Augustus Tolton.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing up Father. And just to clarify a little bit about his name, because sometimes people get antsy about that. On his birth certificate, it says Augustus Tolton, a colored child, property of Stephen Elliott.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So his birth certificate actually says Augustus, but... when we use his name, we kind of Americanize it. We take the Latin out of it. We say Augustine. So
yeah, his gravestone says Augustine.
Fine,
yeah,
but some people get real touchy about it. It's Augustus, not Augustine. And
gotcha.
To me, it's, you know, I don't think he would care. So,
well, yeah, certainly not, especially not from his current vantage point.
right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, for me, growing up in, I grew up in Hillside, New Jersey, a suburb really of Newark, in the Archdiocese of Newark.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a parish that had very few families of color.
Mm-hmm.
We were one of just a handful of black families at that parish.
Yeah.
And I remember... there was no over discrimination or anything like that. We were very well accepted, but There were times that we were studying saints, and, you know, I went to Catholic grade school studying saints, and I'm like, wow, I wish I could find someone that looks like me. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a saint. And so I started to do a little bit. Obviously, there's no internet back then, but I started to do my own little checking, my own little research, and I came across, as a teenager, a Father Tolton.
No, by that, Deacon.
Of course, anything like that.
But Deacon, by that, you mean someone who looks like a football player, right?
someone that was in the church that, yeah. I read his story, the struggles that he had, and I was like, wow, you know, I said, this guy is pretty incredible. So, mm-hmm. You know, fast forward a number of years later, when the book on his life was re-released, by Ignatius Press, I was asked to write the new foreword.
Terrific.
Yeah,
Slave to Priest?
Yeah, From Slave to Priest. Yeah, because Sister mm-hmm. Hemisath has since died, and the bishop that wrote the first foreword also is deceased. And so they knew of my admiration for Father Tolton, so they asked me to write the foreword, the re-release of the book on his life.
Mm-hmm. And we should note, he's now servant of God, we might know, to people who
servant
don't...
Servant of God, yeah. That's right. Servant of God on the step to priesthood. And actually, on the way to sainthood. And actually, you know, I was asked by the Archdiocese of Chicago to assist in that process. And I wasn't very successful because my task was to find speeches, you know, written copies of speeches that he made. You know, he did not like public speaking per se, but... He mm-hmm. went to raise money to build his church when he was in Chicago. So he would go around speaking, and I found newspaper articles that talked about colored priests, you know, to speak here or that kind of, but I mm-hmm. could not find any notes at all about what, you know, recorded what he said. He kept handwritten notes. He didn't write anything out, you know, formally. So I wasn't too successful in helping them, you know, with the compilation of the stuff that went to Rome. But mm-hmm. he was always an inspiration to me. And I think the biggest thing, you know, when I look at his story, I'm like, why did this guy stay Catholic? Why did he stay Catholic? I mean, if you look at his early life, when after his mom and his brothers and his sister escaped from slavery, his father died in the Civil War. His mom escaped through the Underground Railroad, made their way to Quincy, Illinois, and wanted to go to Catholic school. And the priest was very accepting. The nuns were very accepting, but the parishioners were not. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would say things like, if they would say to the pastor, Father, if this family continues to stay here, we'll pull our financial assistance from the parish. Mm-hmm. You know, we will leave the Catholic faith if that family continues to worship here with us.
Wow.
And so a lot of time we talk about discrimination in the church and the church. But who when we're talking about the church, who are we talking about here? It was the priests and the nuns that the ones that opened their arms wide to Father Tolton and his family. It was the parishioners who were not. And even after he was ordained, there were priests that called him, quote unquote, nigger priest to his face.
Yeah.
You know, and they were told, because he accepted everyone into his parish, black, white, doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's so white Deacon Harold, that's
Catholics
important.
Started going to his parish, they were told, it does not count for your Sunday obligation if you continue to go to his church.
You just raised a really important point. Father Augustus did not intend to build a little black ghetto or enclave of black Catholics only. He saw his mission to all the baptized. So the discrimination... Despite the opposition from people in the pews, perhaps the encouragement of the priests and nuns and the bishop there probably inspired him to keep going and be a priest for all. He wasn't intending a racially segregated congregation, correct?
Oh, that's exactly correct. You know, he welcomed everyone, and that was taught to him by the priest, because as you mentioned, no seminary would take him or accept him. The Franciscans wouldn't even take him or accept him. So some priest took on the task of teaching him privately philosophy, theology. He was a catechist. He actually went out and taught other black Catholics, you know, the faith of the Catholic Church. And you would ask yourself, why did this guy stay Catholic? You know, or it was like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Well, going through everything that he did. But here's the beautiful thing. Father Tolton was able to discern what many Catholics today who leave the church, who have issues with the church, fail to perceive and do not fully appreciate, that what the Catholic Church actually teaches is true and good and beautiful, despite the hypocrisy and the contradiction of church members who do not actually live and profess the faith.
So, Deacon, just for a second, if I can interject, you're saying Father Augustus was undeterred by the people in the pews who didn't accept the teaching of the church. He was drawn to continue his studies and continue his priestly ministry because he believed fully in Jesus Christ and the teaching of the faith, even if it wasn't lived out by his fellow Catholics.
Absolutely. And Father Tolton was able to discern what many Catholics today who have issues with the church or who leave the church fail to perceive and don't fully appreciate, that what the Catholic Church actually teaches is true and good and beautiful, mm-hmm. despite the hypocrisy and contradiction of church members who do not actually live what they profess. And Father Tolton was able to make that distinction. In fact, when he went to Rome, because Rome is the one who trained him as the Vatican, took him when nobody else would and trained him as a priest, he did not feel any discrimination or racism there at all. He felt most at home and most himself when he was in Rome. And so I think that's important to recognize that.
That's a, and thanks be to God for that, that in the closest to the arms of the mother in Rome, he felt like he was a beloved son. Did he intend to go to Africa as a missionary? I understand he was very good with languages. He understood German. He spoke French, probably Italian, and his studies would have been in Latin. That must have been a jaw dropper when he got that call that on the eve of ordination, look, you're coming back to Illinois as a priest here.
Yeah, because the whole thing about Africa was years before he was accepted by the Vatican, several, as I mentioned, several priests were taking on his studies privately. And when they started looking at exploring the idea of the priesthood, they were looking, since no U.S. seminaries would take him, mm-hmm. they were looking at other orders who had apostolates outside of the United States. So Borneo was one of the places early on that he thought he might go. And that opened his mind to the idea that I can minister someplace besides the United States. So mm-hmm. when he went to Rome, because remember, at that time in Rome, when he was studying, he was accepted into the what's called the Propagandi Fidei, the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith. Mm-hmm. And this was a branch of the Vatican that took men from countries that did not have seminaries, trained them at the Vatican, and sent them back to those countries to be priests. Mm-hmm. So the first time when a bishop made a very weak appeal to the Vatican on Father Tolton's behalf, they didn't accept it. They said, well, why don't you just send him? You have seminaries in the United States. Just send him to one of those. The bishop, of course, failed to mention that he was rejected by all the seminaries in the United States. And so
sure.
he had to go through a back door through the Superior General of the Franciscans in Rome to talk to the cardinal who was in charge of the program and then accept Father Tolton there.
Right.
So he thought, okay, I'm going to be trained to go to another country that doesn't have a seminary and that needs a priest. So he thought Africa. And that was filling his heart, this idea of being a missionary in Africa. But then after ordination, when he was told he was going back to the United States, and especially back to Quincy, Illinois,
yeah.
his heart just sank. And he went before the Blessed Sacrament. And the description is almost like the agony in the garden. Mm-hmm. He's like, take this cup from me.
Right.
You can't possibly be doing this to me after all this work and to go back there and face what I, you know, and he knew it was coming. But then he had to, again, just like our Lord in the garden, you know, Father, thy will, not mine be done. And then he had a sense of peace. You know, this is what the Lord wants. I'm a faithful servant of the Lord. I'm going to do what the Lord asks. And so he went back. He celebrated his first Mass, actually, in New Jersey. He went to the School Sisters of Notre Dame, were the ones who taught him German, mm-hmm. And he said Mass there for the first time, and then he went to New York and did his first Sunday Mass there, and then made his way back to Quincy. And you know, Father Tolton always acknowledged the great gift of his Catholic faith and recognized that personal sin and human weakness are not greater or more powerful than the strength of the truth found in the Catholic faith. And I love him, Father Tolton, because he was a visionary who saw far beyond the issues that seem to drag us down in this country today, issues of race and politics. And he looked inward, you know, into the heart of the church herself. Mm-hmm. He even said that one of the quotes I was able to find said that the Catholic Church deplores a double slavery, that of the mind and that of the body. She endeavors to free us both. In this church, we don't have to fight for our rights because we are black. The church is broad and liberal, meaning generous. Mm-hmm. She is the church for our people.
I was reading some ancestry articles relative to Father Tolton's burial, and apparently his casket was placed deep in the ground so that another priest who died in the 1900s early on could be buried above him. It just looks like prejudice plagued him even after death. Had you read that? That his I'm looking at a photo of his gravestone, which, as you pointed out, says Augustine, Father Augustine Tolton, but it's on the reverse side. Were you aware of that? That his casket was buried beneath someone else? I mean, this is the late 1890s. You still had whites. To me, it's like almost funny. You have white cemeteries and black cemeteries, as though the soil matters, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Right. We all go back to where we came.
And, that's right. And he, would you agree that he really died on his feet? I understand he collapsed on the sidewalk at age 43 during a heat wave, in the midst of working on some other project, but he worked super hard and collapsed as a result. I understand that's the way he died.
Yeah, that's correct. He always put others before himself. His ministry to his people as a priest was first and foremost, to the detriment of his own health. He died of uremia, which is a side effect of heat stroke.
Yeah.
It's when your body doesn't release the toxins that it needs to through, you know, urine and things like that. So, so that's how he died. Again, walking between parishes to reach out to the community. And he died doing the work that he was ordained to do as a priest. And, you know, and I would love to see his legacy carry forward, not just being, you know, I mean, of course, he's servant of God now, but not just being named a saint, but some of the things that he stood for, back in those days, dealing with what he had to deal with and still staying faithful to the church. I think this country and the church in this country and all of us, regardless of our faith, can learn a lot from the witness of his life. And how he loved and saw people with the eyes of faith and saw people the way that Adam looked at Eve in Genesis chapter 2, and they saw each other as naked and not ashamed. And we need to recapture that sense and that that beauty of how God made us. And I think he's a powerful witness to that for the world today.
Deacon Harold, do you think it's too controversial to say that Orthodox Catholics are the new blacks relative to the culture of death and the redefinition of marriage, that we're all supposed to be standing out in a conspicuous way against persecution, which, if you look around, it's already begun?
Well, you know, that's an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. For a long I'm not trying to find a way to say this delicately, but here's the deal. For many years in the African American community, when you look back, you know, we espoused the values of our African ancestors, where family was critical. I mean, Africans would never think of killing an innocent child in the womb, no matter the circumstances of that child. For example, you know, there's a lot of tribal strife and warfare in certain parts of Africa, the continent of Africa, certain countries there. And if a woman is raped, they would never think of killing the child because she was raped, because they knew it wasn't the child's fault.
Yeah.
But when we come to the United States now, you know, we have a lot of people who want to take a lot of pride in their African roots. You know, we want to call our kids African names and put on African clothes and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to accept African values. You know, we want to call ourselves members of a faith community, but when we, in our political life, you know, doesn't match the way we say that we want to live.
Yeah.
And so there's always been a distension there within the Black Catholic community of actually, you know, following the teachings of the church, but yet trying to remain true to our African heritage. And I think the Father Tolton is the one that helps us strike that wonderful balance. I mean, he was faithful to the church despite everything else that was going on. And yes, even though we're still dealing with it today, and we still need to talk about it, we don't want to bring up things like Planned Parenthood, which is, you know, exterminating, and Margaret Sanger's own words, wants to exterminate an entire race of people.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to talk about that. We don't want to talk about where our husbands and fathers are, about our preoccupation with the materiality of the culture, getting drunk or high. The street gangs, pornography, sleeping around, all those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to talk about abortion. You know, we don't want to talk about contraception. We don't want to, and we need to.
Sure.
You know, since 1993, legal abortion has killed more African Americans than AIDS, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and violent crime combined.
Right.
You know, every week, more Black children die in abortion clinics than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. I mean, mm-hmm. these things that we need to be aware of when we're talking about discrimination. You know, one thing that I wish I could find this on YouTube. I really do, because I have not been able to find this, and I hope maybe someone listening to this podcast can direct me to it. I was watching before the election. Mm-hmm. Of Obama the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching, I was just flipping through the channels, because I rarely watch television, but I think I was folding laundry or something. I was flipping through the channels, I saw an interview, and I don't remember what station it was. It was a news person interviewing people from the Aryan Nation. And
right.
He was talking about how he was going to vote for Obama. And I said, whoa, wait a minute, that got my attention. So this guy from the Aryan Nation is going to vote for Obama. And so when the interviewer asked him why, he said, because of abortion. He said, you know, we don't need to, you know, burn crosses and do all this other. We'll let the niggas kill themselves. And I went,
wow.
Whoa. I mean, that just rocked me. And I've been trying to find it ever since. And I can't find where I saw that. But that was eye-opening for me. It was a revelation.
Sure.
For me about the work that still needs to be done to raise awareness of this important issue.
I know that Esquire magazine covered something like that in 2009. If you look in the June 11th, I just did a quick search. It's called Why White Supremacists Support Barack Obama in Esquire.
Okay.
There may be a link there.
Oh, thank you, Patrick. I appreciate that very much. Because I literally was shell shocked after. And I said, write it down. And later, my mom said, write it down. I couldn't remember. So thank you, Patrick. I appreciate that.
I'm just talking about this this strange tie-in between the extreme ideologues of Planned Parenthood and Aryan Nations and so on. I'm thinking of a quote that Dr. Elvita King made, I think in the 60s. This is the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., I believe, who works with Father Pavone.
Yes.
She said, was it coincidence, or could it be that when we said we would no longer sit in the back of the bus, a place was being reserved for us down at the abortion clinic?
Wow. That's powerful.
Now, do you think that the way out here is not politics, and it's not argumentation, it's not rallies, and it's not protests, it's not bumper stickers, it's the gospel?
Oh, there's no question about it. And there's no doubt in my mind that Father Tolton would agree with that. And that is exactly how he lived and ministered. To have people focus on the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, if we say that we truly are disciples, we truly are followers of Christ, then we need to do what Christ says: deny ourselves, pick up our cross, and follow him. You know what that means when you do that? People are going to hate you. People are going to call you names. You know, I get called things like intolerant. I don't appreciate diversity. I'm closed-minded. I'm bigoted. I'm too conservative. A priest even told me once I'm too Catholic. You know, even some Black Catholics in the past have called me Uncle Tom Catholic. because I'm in EWTN, I'm in the white man's church and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, just completely ignorant statements that, again, are designed to stir emotions. And what we need to do is to let them, guys, call me whatever names you want. Keep going.
Yeah.
You know, once you're finished, okay, are you done yet? Now let's have a conversation. You know, they wanted to stir your emotions up so much that you don't think. And what I loved about Father Tolton and the Catholic Church is that he's ignored the pejorative remarks and comments and discriminate and just thought, let's think and let's focus on the gospel and let's go there. And that's what we need to do. We need to go there. You know?
And for people who are thin-skinned about whether it was Augustine or Augustus, Father Tolton got around all that by being called Good Father Gus. So he did an end around.
Yeah, that's right. Good Father Gus. That's right.
Well, Deacon Harold, thanks so much for joining us. I can talk about the saints endlessly, especially this one. I think Father Tolton's life is a movie waiting to be written. Can't you see like Wesley Snipes or Denzel playing him? Piece of cake.
That would be awesome. I think they'd do a fantastic job.
No, it's got all the drama. I mean, there's so many things in that story, and maybe we'll have you back on or talk about other things that have a fire in your belly, Deacon. Always a pleasure.
Well, you know, St. Luke Productions is going to be starting something on Father Tolton pretty soon here.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll watch for that.
Yeah.
Can we get your Deacon blessing on our people and our staff?
Sure, absolutely. May Almighty God bless all of you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Dynamic Deacon, God bless you richly. We'll have you back on Catholic Answers Live soon enough.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
All right.
God bless you and all your listeners.
Very good. The website is dynamicdeacon or deaconharold.com. Bring him to your next event. You will not be sorry. Up next, Kevin Costner. Actor Kevin Costner has appeared in some of the most iconic and popular films in U.S. history, like Dances with Wolves, The Untouchables, JFK, Field of Dreams. He's starring in a new film now called Black or White, co-starring Academy Award-winning actress Octavia Spencer. It's a custody battle. It's about forgiveness. It's about race relations. But it's more about the power of family and the decision to forgive. Actor Kevin Costner joins us now from his remote location doing a tour for Black or White on the East Coast. In some ways, your new movie, Black or White, would represent a certain risk for an actor in light of the police clashes and racial tension and so on. I wanted to ask you right off the bat, what won you over to the project and to the role?
Well, I didn't think it was, I didn't think it was courageous. I didn't think it was risky. I thought it was really honest. And I thought, wow, I'm always comfortable if something's honest because I don't have anything to apologize for.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's about my own time, about what I think feels broken out there, I feel even a greater obligation to share it. I would have felt worse about running away from it.
I was reading some of the comments on the trailer YouTube channel, and people on both ends of the racial divide, if you will, have reacted somewhat viscerally, never having seen the film. But having seen it myself, I can say it has nothing to do with race relations. It has more to do with forgiveness and a human story.
Yeah, and that's this jump to conclusion. That's this idea where you can start to critique a trailer. My God. So the shallowness of those who would even kind of get drawn into a discussion based on a trailer, you know, and if those people would in any way scare people off from seeing this movie, I almost want to say shame on them because there's so much truth in this movie, and there's so many things that get said that people have been unable to articulate themselves. It's surprisingly warm, this movie, yet it doesn't pull punches. So it's kind of a miracle, actually.
Yeah, it's not the kind of trailer where the best parts are in it either. Having seen the film, the best parts are not in the trailer, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely, and that's by design. That's a lot me saying no.
Sure,
we're gonna. You know, everybody goes, no, we got to lead with your right hand more. And I said, no, we don't. I said, we are going to find our champions. I don't know where they'll come from, but it will be people that have seen the movie that have open hearts. Those will be our champions. And us trying to win over any other thing, getting off message, what the movie is intended to say, us trying to soften it, doing. Make it more politically correct, whatever you want to say, is a mistake. I said, this movie will find the people who champion it.
Mm-hmm. Watching the movie reminded me of Kramer versus Kramer. I was watching it and enjoying your performance as Elliot, and it occurred to me that the story is about emotional woundedness and about the effects of addiction on the family more than anything else. I thought to myself, would I watch it if it had nothing to do with race? The answer is yes, I would.
Yeah, well, there are some roots there in that particular movie. You can see them, and mm-hmm. a completely original take and set against this world of racism that we have been dealing with since the formation of this country, and before that, actually. And we have it's a cloud that has chased us. It's one that we're making some progress on. There's a lot of enlightened people. A movie like this, I think, generates conversation that can accelerate that conversation. But there's just the same weird wickedness of people who would debate a trailer,
yeah,
with such vitriol, is just really that the energy that must go into that kind of discussion versus the good that people could talk about. It's just unbelievable to me.
And the title's not Black versus White. Obviously there's a play on words there.
Yeah, it's almost a rhetorical black mm-hmm. or white. You know, the question wants to be like, well, who cares? It doesn't matter. Should it be black or white? No, it doesn't matter. In this instance, it's about the welfare of a child. Mm-hmm. And where is this child going to be loved and nurtured? Turns out, lo and behold, it could benefit from both households.
Mm-hmm. One word that occurred to me to describe the chemistry between you and Octavia Spencer, especially in the courtroom scenes, who plays Grandma Wee Wee, of course, is fun. There's a real chemistry between you two as you enter the epic battle.
Yeah, that's a highlight of the movie, all through the movie. I mean, the sense of humor that runs through Black or White, while it still is hitting so close to the bone, is kind mm-hmm. of a really fine dance. It's an incredible screenplay.
Yeah, and all the characters are flawed. There's black heroism and white heroism, and black flawedness and weakness, and all the characters have
absolutely
their compassionate giving side, too.
And you find yourself alternatively laughing at it,
right,
and then being kind of appalled by it.
And wondering if I should be laughing, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's no explicit reference to faith in the film, but there's a beautiful portrayal, I think, of the fact that love and forgiveness are choices that sometimes fly in the face of feelings. Now, did you find yourself, I'm not sure how
well,
you...
Well, I think that in faith and stuff like that, we find an ability to move forward. And what you feel in this movie, without it being a kumbaya ending, is the ability for a man to move forward,
mm-hmm.
to accept something that he couldn't see before. He was backed into a corner. He was dealing with alcohol, and people were rushing him. And when that happens in life, we dig in.
Mm-hmm.
If he maybe would have had a little more time, you know, he was barely buried his wife, and suddenly phone calls were saying they want shared custody. I just there's a lot in this screenplay that people will never discuss, the nuance of it. But if you think about that, he might have come to this conclusion that we found at the end of the movie had mm-hmm. he not been rushed. But when he's rushed, people get defensive. And when they get defensive, they need to win. And when they need to win, they're willing to pull out all the stops. Race becomes an issue.
Right. And speaking of chemistry, I thought the chemistry between you and your late wife was, she's almost the co-star of the film. She seems present, although not seen, in every decision that Elliot makes.
Yeah, and boy, does he wish she was around, because she was, she not only was the person who gave love to this child and did all those things, but part of what was unique was now he was going to have to take over those duties. And you mm-hmm. can see that doesn't matter how hard he was going to try to do it, there's some things a woman can do. And mm-hmm. it was really interesting to me.
Your character, Elliot Anderson, is kind of an anti-Elliot Ness. It's a big change up for you. Here's this paunchy, crabby, boozy grandfather. It also looked like you're having fun, just letting yourself go in a good way.
Well, I think he had to. I think I put on the weight. I let the hair go. I let it all go. Because when you don't have your woman, you don't know how to take care of yourself. The things that they did that made you sharp are not there. But I was armed with incredible dialogue, some speeches of a lifetime, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in the courtroom scene. And also absentmindedly walking with one sock on, one sock off on the sidewalk outside the house.
You know,
that's a nice
getting
touch
in the wrong van.
Yeah, right, exactly right. In addition to box office mojo and golden accolades from your peers, what are your hopes for the film? What kind of conversation do you hope to jumpstart with this movie?
Well, I hope it's a massive success in that it's a movie that wants to be shared.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a movie that travels through time. You know, we measure movies so often on how they do on their opening weekend, when in fact the value of a movie is that one that you'll take off the shelf 10 years from now, 20 years from now. Will this movie be relevant? That is what I want for this movie, and that's why all the decisions that were made were designed to not soften it, to make it as relevant as it could possibly be. And that means all the flaws are shown and all the possibilities are shown. And when we do, I think we have ability to have a higher understanding when we're absolutely honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the watchword of the film. It raises stereotypes only to shoot them down for what they are. Keep you focused on the story itself. Well, Kevin Costner, you have amazing staying power as an actor. I was just reviewing your IMDb history. Just so great to see you continue to be on top. May God bless you richly. All the best with this film.
Well, thank you. That was beautifully said. And certainly, I don't walk alone.
Yep. Amen to that. Thanks for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. Bye-bye. Black or White opened nationwide on January 30th. Check local listings. I'm Patrick Coffin. This is Catholic Answers Focus.